Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So, here we are, 11-11-20, and heading for a Friday the 13th, always a lucky day for me, so hopefully my luck will hold. I guess that's what we're all saying. Nowadays, there's been so much going on. But I'll be doing some emails. But I have a little bit of a commentary on the big news of the week, which was the Pfizer vaccine. But before we go there, Francine, with her email, kind of jumped me to talk about something else. And 11-11-G, there's enough time maybe for me to make a dent on people. So let me read what Francine wrote. Hello, Dawn. We have new data about how consumers are not waiting for a vaccine to travel. Some highlights are below. Almost 20% of travelers think it is okay to travel now. Less than that are waiting for a vaccine, according to Oliver Wyman. Personal judgment outweighs government advice when deciding to travel. Pent-up demand could drive holiday travel up despite increasing COVID cases. Okay, this is interesting, right? It's got a lot of caps in it. I think it's promotional. News about COVID vaccines are promising, but most consumers surveyed are not waiting for a vaccine to travel, and an increasing number of travelers say it is okay to travel now, according to a new report from Oliver Wyman. Vaccines are important, but personal judgment is still the leading factor for deciding to travel, ahead of government restrictions and advice from the World Health Organization, said Bruce Speer, a partner of Oliver Wyman. This means the travel industry must focus on measures that increase individual customer safety, such as mandatory masks, cleaning, and rapid testing, and not wait for governments to issue directives. The report, anticipating the travel recovery, found several other changes in traveler behavior since the first survey was conducted in early April. And there's a link. Okay. I know we've been talking about air travel and the safety of air travel, so I'm going to refer you to a couple of previous shows and not spend too much time on that today. But the question of should you travel for Thanksgiving really comes up in my mind. And I have to share with you a story that happened to be just this week. A woman that I know, an acquaintance, was telling me how she planned to travel to Arizona with her husband to see her mother, who was in her 90s. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. What's your plan? And she was telling me all the safety measures they were going to take and how they were going to drive straight through and pee in the bushes, and they weren't going to stop for anything. And I said, well, you know, what's your route? Because LA is purple. Are you going to go through LA? Because you might want to go around LA. It's not a good idea to end up in an emergency room right now in Los Angeles, I should think. And we talked about alternatives of routes. And then I said, so what's your plan for quarantine when you get there? And she said, oh, well, we're going to quarantine for 14 days at mom's house. Mom's the one who's 90, right? This person actually works with the public. Now, she works in a business that is, in my opinion, doing everything right. They're very diligent, but it is nevertheless a business where people are inside all day long, and multiple people do go through wearing masks, yes, but nevertheless, that's not 100%. So I was suggesting to her that maybe she would want to get a test for COVID. Turnaround time now has dropped to about 72 hours for the facility down at Ramsey Park. And word has it they're going to be opening up another one soon. So it starts to look like, you know, get a test. Then when the test comes back, you know, while you're waiting for that test, don't go anywhere. Stay home and really quarantine. Take the week off from work before you go see your mom. Get a test about halfway through that week. And, you know, maybe stay in a motel till you get a negative test back. And ditto for your husband, because you both need to make sure you're clear before you walk into the house of a 90-year-old woman and stay there for Thanksgiving. We all want to see our families. I am so frustrated that I can't visit with my nieces and my nephews who are growing so fast. I get it. we're in the middle of a major, massive flare of this, and this is not the time to travel for Thanksgiving. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the news of the week. As I said, the Pfizer vaccine, and that was announced on Monday, caused a great bump in the stock market. And I think right now, what we can say is that Wall Street is feeling very bullish about the fact that we might be getting back to something resembling a normal economy. Tech stocks dropped because they've gone, well, sort of ballistic during the shutdown and the sequestration of people and the, you know, the limitations on businesses. So that's an anticipation that, hey, think happy days are here again. But, you know, you've got to think about some of the challenges that we're going to have with this vaccine. We're going to talk in detail about the vaccine in just a moment. But the Pfizer vaccine, it has been in the works. It is a messenger RNA vaccine, and that is something of a cause for concern. Moderna's vaccine, which is also in stage three, is an RNA vaccine. No one, we've never had an RNA vaccine ever. And we really don't know about the long-term problems with an RNA vaccine. But the thing is, you can build viral RNA. You can design it and build it. So it's a lot easier than doing a vaccine the old-fashioned way. So that's why these two platforms are first to the party, so to speak. So what about this vaccine? Well, the announcement on November 9th said that they had 90% effectiveness. What's that based on? Well, they had 43,000 trial participants. I want to mention that many of these trial participants, it hasn't even been 2 months for some of them on the vaccine. They had 94 cases of COVID amongst the trial participants, and most of those were in people who had not had the vaccine. So if you do the math, 90% effective means 84% of the hits were in the placebo group, which means about 9 cases were in the group that got the vaccine. You also have 94 cases and 43,000 trial participants, and they've told us, although they haven't specified, that there are older people in this group. Well, the hit rate there for cases in 94 cases and 43,000, that's 0.002. That's 208 cases per 100,000. That's low. In fact, if it were double, it would still be a little bit on the low side. The United States is at about 761 cases per 100,000 a week ago, and we know we've gone up a lot since then. As I was talking to a friend today, she commented about side effects, and she was very worried about things she's been reading on the internet. She has a lot of time on her hands. There were anecdotal reports, essentially 4 people who were in the trial or claimed to be in the trial and supposedly were validated to be in the trial by the news entity that broke the story, stated that they had flu-like symptoms after the vaccine. And one person, after the second shot of the vaccine, was very unhappy with how bad they felt. And I was listening to the symptoms: body aches, low-grade fever, malaise, muscle pains, headaches. And it's like, oh, well, those are cytokine symptoms. We've all had cytokines defined for us, chemical signals that the immune system uses to talk to each other, to recruit additional cells, to amplify the immune response. And there are also cytokines that do the opposite, that act as a braking mechanism. Ordinarily, it all stays balanced. We get the flu, we feel crappy for 2 weeks, and then we're all better. People with autoimmune disease have a problem with making antibodies to their own tissue. And in that case, we sometimes use effectively cytokine blockers to help them, which works well. It helps their symptoms. But sometimes 10 years out, the people taking the cytokine blockers have, well, a statistically higher rate of lymphoma and a type of blood cancer. So it took 10 years to figure that out. And that's an important point. So let's talk about the cytokine side effects. They're the exact same side effects of the Shingrix vaccine. And if you aren't living in a cave, I'm sure you've heard of the shingles vaccine and the statistic that 1 in 3 people will get shingles in their lifetime, which is a bogus statistic, by the way. People take the shingles vaccine because shingles sucks way worse than 2 to 3 days of feeling achy and tired. And shingles doesn't kill you. So let's talk about risk. Currently, in the United States and France and most of the industrialized countries of the world that have hospitals and ICUs and modern medical care, they have about a 0.2% death rate from COVID cases. So, yeah, it's pretty much, you know, a hundredth of a percentage point off between countries. Call it a wash. It's about the same. I saw statistics this morning, however, that worldwide, it's about 2% of people who get COVID die. And that is talking about equity and inequality and the fact that resources in many parts of the world are very short. We had an earlier program. If you've listened over from that program to this one, you'll remember the comments about Yemen. So here's what my concerns are. And this is my concern about anything new. Drugs, absolutely. Any kind of chemical. I'm a little more concerned here because this is a new vehicle. And we don't have any prior examples of what an RNA vaccine will do. So it's a big question mark. But suppose that 1 in 100,000 people were to get a severe reaction. I could think of several weird things that RNA could do, a few that it won't do. And this meme that's currently circulating on the internet is, it won't change your DNA. For one thing, it's RNA, not DNA, and you don't have reverse transcriptase to turn RNA into DNA. So it literally cannot change your DNA. And that is a false meme that's making the rounds. It could do something rare and weird in 5 to 10 years, but we will never know this until 5 to 10 years from now. And I personally don't want to stay in lockdown for 5 to 10 years. In cancer, for example, we call you cured if cancer doesn't come back after 5 years, because most of the time it doesn't after 5 years. But everybody knows someone who's had cancer come back after 10 or even 20 years. So we can never draw a line until we've gone through an entire lifetime. Assume for the sake of argument that this new RNA technology does work, but it messes up in 1 per 100,000 people. That's pretty good odds, real good odds, actually. Most medical therapies are worse than that. But here's the problem. You test 45,000 people on a vaccine study, and then you push for an emergency use authorization because, hey, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. And maybe someone even gets the weird thing in that 45,000 people. You won't notice it. You'd need good surveillance and 5 to 10 cases of something weird to notice. And it's not so unusual for something weird to happen. During the swine flu epidemic in the 70s, the swine flu vaccine actually did, in certain susceptible individuals, cause a form of paralysis called Guillain-Barré syndrome. The number of cases was very small. If you do the math, it protected more people than it hurt, but nevertheless, it did create a problem that no one could have anticipated. This week, Brazil halted a trial of one of the Chinese vaccines because someone, 1 out of a 10,000-person cohort, died. A month ago, AstraZeneca vaccine was halted. Then, after a thorough investigation, it was restarted. So the first thing you do is you halt the trial when something bad happens, and then you go look for plausibility, look for a connection, make sure you can really assign cause and effect. So 1 per 100,000. We've got 300 million people in the United States. So that would give us 3,000 cases of weird thing that it might take a while to figure out. If once we get the entire population vaccinated, what about 1 in 10,000? Well, that's 30,000 cases. That's still a pretty acceptable risk, and there's always a risk. So the thing you need to think about is risk versus benefit. So let's talk about patients. Okay, your risk of death from COVID, so far as we've been able to see in nursing home outbreaks, it's easily 25%, probably more like 50% in the very elderly. So your risk of the vaccine, 1 in 100,000 in our thought problem? Well, small potatoes compared to the virus. Clear case. How about first responders, ICU and ER nurses and doctors? Nurses, by the way, are at much higher risk because they spend more time with patients. Anybody will tell you that who's been in a hospital lately. You can bet that people in hospitals use PPE, but some still get sick and some die. Very few of these people will refuse the vaccine. Just my personal calculation. I'm a 62-year-old woman with asthma. I'm scared of this disease. I'm scared of ending up on a ventilator. What would it take for me to get the vaccine? Any of the vaccines? Well, actually, given what I consider my risk to be, not all that much. I'd want clear, peer-reviewed science, outside sources, and that's coming, but it isn't here yet. I'd want data in my age group. We don't have that. Pfizer didn't release that, and I think that's incredibly important because the older you get, the way your immune response changes, and it may not be as vigorous. In fact, it's a good bet it won't be. So how good is it in the people who are most vulnerable? What about giving a different vaccine? What if I do this vaccine and my immunity fades? Will I be able to take another vaccine that comes along later? Would that cause some kind of weird reaction? Well, we've got our pedal to the metal, folks, and we have no idea. And that's one of the, let's say, theoretical scenarios that really concerns me. Information about how long it lasts, I'd want that. How long does the immunity last? Does the antibody level remain stable in my blood? Or does it drop, like in the infected cases, after several months? Will it prevent spread in people who've been vaccinated, or will it not? Will it make it worse because they're not having symptoms, but they're still shedding virus? This is new territory, and I anticipate that the data will come, and I actually expect that most of these platforms will be okay, and I will take the vaccine, but I have to say that Mr. Azar's speech today made me angry, okay? He basically had some claims. I'm trying to find what they were. Oh, yes. He said that the Pfizer vaccine is going to be starting production in late November. He's already decided to give it an EUA. In other words, it doesn't have one. He'd have to do that. Plus, a bunch of other people would have to sign off on it. But, you know, he's not exactly objective here. This guy's got his foot on the... He's a lead foot. This is really... really an egregious kind of violation of what he should be saying. He also said that we'll have 20 million of this vaccine, 20 million delivered to the United States by the end of November, and another 20 million in December. So by the end of December, you'll have 40 million, and that'll be enough to vaccinate all the vulnerable people. Well, that's crazy. We have way more vulnerable people than that. And this vaccine requires 2 doses 3 weeks apart. So that's going to be tricky to manage. When I talked about logistics and coming back to you over the next few weeks, that's one of the big ones that we're going to be talking about. So actually, we've got 20 million people we can vaccinate. It's not going to cover all of the people who need it. So all right, in January, we'll have another 20 million, and then we'll have another 20 million. And if they can keep the rate up, we will eventually get all the doctors and nurses vaccinated, but we won't have that done by the end of January, which is what he's estimated. There are 1 million doctors and nurses who would be considered first responders in California, all right? And there's a few others over the rest of the state. So all I'm saying is that that speech was ridiculous, and it made me angry because I want my people in office and in authority to not be BSing us because it erodes credibility, and it's real hard to get credibility back after you've blown it. So here's some other thoughts before we wrap up. What if you had a box of strips And you could just swab your nose like a pregnancy test, you know, swab your nose, put some liquid on it, wait 5 minutes. I'm sure most of you have had the strep test. That's how that works. And then you'd learn if you had COVID in your nose. Let's further suppose that was 90% accurate. Sure, misses 10%, but those are the low levels of virus, less likely to spread widely. If you remember the movie Juno, when she's pregnant, she's trying to push fluids and get a negative pregnancy test, and it isn't working. Very funny scene. What would it change if you had that test? Well, for one thing, if you were positive, you'd quarantine for 10 days. You'd call your friends and your coworkers, and you'd let them know that you were positive and tell them to check themselves and quarantine if they were. Furthermore, you could out them if you wanted to on Facebook or Twitter, or not. But it is interesting whether or not voluntary social media would be helpful, because I might see the Twitter feed of the persons whose party I went to last week, and I might not get a call from the health department for, well, let's say longer than I should. But the real weapon here is not rapid antigen tests, and it's not a vaccine. The real super weapon against COVID is masks and personal protective equipment. The data is in. Compare hospital and healthcare providers and their attack rates in New York City and New Jersey and New Orleans in March, when we didn't have adequate PPE. Compare that to now. The results in that experiment are unequivocal. So what's the bomb against COVID? Masks, hand washing, social distancing, and by the way, stay home for Thanksgiving. Staying home for Thanksgiving won't kill you, and it won't kill anybody else. We had a question from Elizabeth, who listened to last week's show. How long until this COVID treatment might be ready for human use? I thought this looked very solid and promising. And what she's interested in, by the way, is the ferrets. And so let me tell you about the ferret study. And we did already talk about this, so I'm going to be just a reminder that because ferrets can get COVID and they're being experimented on, researchers have been trying to find a nasal spray that would work. Last week, we talked about the possibility that betadine and silver might both knock out the virus. There's no data on that. It is plausible. There's data on this product, but of course, it's a product that has that can be used in experimental animals. It's got a long way to go, even with emergency use authorization, before it could be manufactured and distributed and really make a dent in the situation, Elizabeth. We are not going to be able to ferret our way out of this using this spray, although it may, if the virus proves to be short-lived, prove to be extremely useful. If our immunity to the virus, I mean, should be short-lived, then having a preventative spray that we could use, say, oh, next year or over the course of many subsequent years as we get isolated outbreaks starts to make sense. How does it work? Well, it attacks the virus directly. It's basically a cholesterol particle and some amino acids, and it matches a stretch of amino acids in the spike protein of the virus, and it doesn't let the virus fire its RNA inside the cell. It is the classic bubblegum in the keyhole technique that we love to use. We can use antisense mutations. We can do all sorts of things. But, you know, bubblegum in the keyhole effectively prevents someone from unlocking the door. And that's how this works. We can stay tuned. We can hope it happens. In the meantime, I'll refer you to last week. I typically use colloidal silver, but if you can't get that, the dilutions for betadine are there. And I will add that this is kind of becoming a thing in medical circles. And of course, I'm sure that people are also wearing their holy medals and saying their prayers every day before they go to work, especially if they have family that they live with. And I want to just state how proud I am to be in that number of people who are continuing to go out there and take care of the people that need them. And I have just to the first responders, whether they are medical people, emergency people, or food people, we love you, we thank you, and we want you to stay safe. So please remember, COVID's not taking a vacation. We can't afford to either. So let's go to another email. Oh, wait, we have a question. I'm sorry. So let me move to that before we do the email. This was someone sent. Could you please talk about the necessity of flu shot if a person's already in quarantine? Also, please speak about the side effects of injection. I'm 65 plus, and I get the flu maybe once every 10 years, and have had the flu shot only once in my life. Okay, let's talk about the twindemic concern. And that's really the problem. We have no data, none, about whether or not if you've already got the flu and you get COVID on top of that, you have an increased risk of the cytokine storm. It's purely a theoretical concern. But as I said, when you've got the flu, your cytokines get amped up. I'm even discouraging people on the basis of logical extension and speculation. I have no data. I still give the advice not to get Shingrix right now, because the Shingrix vaccination definitely causes cytokines to go up, and I don't want people catching COVID when they've already got their cytokines up. Now, how you're already in quarantine, I don't know if you're in quarantine, Sandra, because you've been designated as infected, or if you mean that you are basically shut down and not going out. Quarantine is a term that refers to people who have a disease and who have been told by the authorities that they need to stay where they are and not expose themselves to other people. It comes from the French 40, which means 40, and it is because back in the old days of sailing ships, if you came into a harbor, they checked the crew for illness. They're trying to prevent bubonic plague and other lovely things. And if anybody was sick on the ship, the ship had to sit in harbor for 40 days before they could unload things. Unfortunately, for maritime precautions, rats did not get quarantined, and they can climb down those ropes that were holding the ship in port. So it didn't really work all that well. For bubonic plague, anyway. But let's see what her other questions were. Should you get the flu shot? What about the side effects? Well, you're 65. I think none of us want to get the flu and then get COVID. I don't want to get the flu and then be hospitalized right now, even though I don't mind going into the hospital for a surgery right now. I think if I'm selective, I would put it off. But if it's life-threatening, please don't stay home. If you've got appendicitis, it's a bad idea. Again, back to that risk-benefit thing. Your risk of the appendicitis is greater than your risk of catching COVID in a hospital. Keep that in mind. So is your risk of dying from a heart attack. You get the flu once every 10 years. Well, that's true. But everything I've just said is still operative. I've had the flu shot only once in my life, and presumably you tolerated it okay, or you would have said so. So let's talk about the side effects of injection. We covered this at the top of the show, Sandra. Cytokines. When you get a shot, I had the flu shot this year, no symptoms whatsoever. That's typical for me. I've had it every year since I became a doctor. Some people will be sore. That means their immune system is actually activating from the vaccine, which means they're going to make a lot of antibodies and probably not get the flu, which is the whole point. So take some aspirin, take some Tylenol, take a whatever is safe for you, because people have different kinds of medical conditions. Take a hot bath with Epsom salt. That works for just about everybody. Please don't faint and fall out of the bathtub while you're exit with assistance if you're 65 plus and feeling a little dizzy. You know, maybe roll out of the tub and wait till you're feeling a little less shaky. Anyway, all I'm saying is be safe. Be safe in all ways. I would suggest the flu shot if you can find, if your physician gives the flu shot in your vehicle. That's a great way to do it. That's how I'm doing it in my office. If people request it, they can just sit in their car and give me an arm. I have no problem with that. And I think the main thing you don't want is be part of the group that gets reported in a scientific paper in 3 years about how much worse you get if you get COVID on top of the flu. You don't want to be in that number when the saints go watching in. So we've covered the ferrets. We've covered Sandra's question. Let's talk about Jackie in Santa Cruz. Jackie wrote a very interesting letter. Your thoughts needed, Dr. D. We so appreciate you and your show every Wednesday. Thanks for being such a gem to our community. Two questions today. What is your theory on rice being so hypoallergenic as baby's first food? Isn't it high in arsenic compared to grains? That's a wash, no? Especially for babies? Well, no. Actually, I think that the arsenic in rice is a potential issue. And let me explain. The FDA allows 10 parts per billion arsenic in water, and it allows 100 parts of billion of organic arsenic in infant rice cereals. The arsenic in rice is invariable. It comes from arsenic coming out in rain. Rice is a very, very water-intensive crop, as you probably know, and it gets a lot of arsenic, and it absorbs it. And so in samples tested in 2018, the numbers were up. What's that from? Well, high sulfur coal burning. Oh, coal burning. You mean coal burning can increase arsenic in the water table? You bet it can. Rain, rain, go away, right? Well, 36% of samples had levels above 100 parts per billion for infant rice cereals in 2011, and now it's 76%. So this is not really great news. It's a good source of iron, but I think what we need to do is rotate. And by the way, rotation is the best way to avoid dietary food allergies in infants, is rotating their diet. If you give them the same thing every day, that can create a problem. Another trick is just, if you're pregnant, eat the food in small amounts, but expose your baby to the foods that your other child is actually allergic to. It turns out that, for peanuts allergies anyway, exposure in utero works. So I think cereals should be rotated. I will go back to your question because you had two. But before I do that, I'm going to take a caller. And the caller is Denise from Los Angeles. Take it away, Denise.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm just calling in because I've had some mysterious pain cyclically for a year and a half now. It's only happens between my after ovulation and before menstruation. It's in my luteal phase. And it can come any time of the day. It can come as many times as 8 times a day. Pain level varies from level 3 to level 8 during the episodes. The pain's cut if I get heat on it right when I start to feel it. And it can end in, like, digestive disruption, like burping and, you know, excess gas. And I've seen a lot of different doctors, and I haven't found any real concrete diagnosis or anything to help me figure out how I can support my body's healing. So I'm just calling in to see if you have any ideas or any leads.
Well, has anyone suggested any treatments, Denise, and what have you tried, if anything?
So, yeah, I've tried, I've done some enemas, Ayurvedic Bhastis, because they thought it might have been colon-related, digestive stuff and maybe a Vata imbalance. I've restricted my gluten in my diet and dairy, which I know I've had muscle testing on, I am sensitive to, but I've completely taken it out for months now. There's been no real suggestion. I mean, they've suggested birth control, which I don't want to take to just omit having a cycle. I recently found out that I had some polyps and some fibroids present, so I thought maybe there's estrogen dominance, but anyways, no doctor has actually given me vitamin B12 shots. They thought might help because I am in a lower weight than I've been in my past, about like 10 pounds lighter than I normally am.
All right. Let me stop you. Yeah. It doesn't sound like you've tried any medications, and I can understand not wanting to do birth control. Are you seeking pregnancy currently?
I'm not.
Okay. So I'm going to kind of approach this. You've seen Western medical doctors, so I'm going to ask you some Chinese medicine questions. And, you know, I'm bimodal, And so maybe we might be able to, first of all, I'll make a comment. Fibroids can do this. They can cause, you know, abdominal pain. But the fact that it's just the second half of your menstrual cycle after you ovulate and gets a little bit better suggests that it's related to progesterone levels, because that's when your progesterone mm-hmm. levels are highest. And it turns out that there is a group of women who get sort of PMS, abdominal cramping, and it is a thing. And there's one study that I know of that had people take calcium at fairly high levels, like 500 milligrams twice a day, and that they had a statistically reduced level of symptoms. And that's something that you could start right away. That's one study, and it's small, and who knows? But it also falls into the won't hurt, might help category. You could give this a try.
Great.
So that's one possibility. I want to just talk about the Chinese medicine and ask you a few questions. The quality of the pain, okay? Give me descriptors, okay? Is it sharp? Is it dull? Is it crampy? Is it stabbing? Is it burning? You know, what of those rings a bell for you?
I would say it's cramping, and it sometimes feels sharp, but sometimes it feels radiating.
Okay, well, radiating, given the way that the nervous system in the gut is designed, it's a bit like, what would make a sense? There are a lot of things that plug in to the belly button that come from all sorts of different directions. So if you could think of the belly button as an outlet with like six different outlets, you've got nerves coming from the appendix and nerves coming from the colon and nerves coming from the ovaries. And they all kind of pass through one of three outlets to get to the brain. And there's no evolutionary value in localization of abdominal pain, except in the situations where you have like appendicitis or something, or you're bleeding ulcers. So most of the time, you won't feel it where it is. And that's a problem with all of these pains. And it can travel to the back, and it's just, you know, things get kind of confused and tangled up in the spinal cord. And so the thing that abdominal exam that doctors do, we're basically looking for abdominal wall pain. We're looking for big things that, you know, like things that are too big or hard, but we're also looking for abdominal wall pain because that it'll be under that pain, whatever it is. But in our case, it sounds more like a diffuse thing. So a couple more Chinese medicine questions. I want to know about your menstrual flow. And basically, nobody ever asks in Western medicine this, but there are kind of two patterns. There's either kind of thin and reddish menstrual flow, where it's maybe even a little bit, for part of the flow, it's a little bit like watered down menstrual fluid, but it's usually bright red. And then there's clot, and kind of clumpy, and usually it's kind of dark purple. And so does it, which one is that more like?
I'd say it's more like the dark clotty.
Okay. So it sounds like we might be looking at a abdominal pain from Chinese medicine that would be related to cold or stagnation. So let's see if we can confirm that. Do you have night sweats and thirst and with this, either being very thirsty at night or sweating at night?
No.
Okay. And do you have very cold hands and feet?
I do, yes.
Okay. And then do you get pain in the low back?
Not really, no.
All right. So it's a little bit ambiguous, and I want to emphasize I am not an expert in Chinese medicine the way I am an expert in the Western arts of medicine, and I'm pretty good acupuncturist, but I never really learned the herbs all that well. There are these things in Chinese called patent medicine, and I think I'm remembering it. I think what you sound like is more like a kidney qi or a kidney problem, in not that your kidney, anything's wrong with your organ, the kidney, but that the energy that we call kidney qi And when we talk about the kidney and spleen in Chinese medicine, it's like it has nothing to do with the kidney or the spleen in Western medicine. It's that, like, I grew up calling the 405 freeway the Ventura Freeway because it went to Ventura. I mean, the 101, mm-hmm. the Ventura Freeway, because it went to Ventura. But mm-hmm. it just passed through it and kept going, right? But we named it.
Right.
And that's how the Chinese medicine, these names mean. So you might do, I want you to try something and get back to me next month. Mm-hmm. And what I want you to do is go to a Chinese acupuncturist and get them to put moxa, which is a herbal, it's a Chinese mugwort actually, and have them burn mm-hmm. moxa over the kidneys, which is in on your back, and then flip you over and burn it over the ovaries and see if that shifts the symptoms.
Okay.
That would be confirmatory, and there are herbs that will work for that. And okay. so you could do that with the calcium on the next cycle and see what you get. If it's improved, then keep on, stay on the calcium, get the herbs, take the herbs. And then if you want to give up on one of them for any reason, you take one away and see if you get worse again.
Mm-hmm.
Calcium, as it happens, interestingly enough, is used to calm in Chinese medicine. There's this thing called five elements theory. I'm not going to go into that. But let's just say that too much calcium could create a problem in the kidneys, as I think we all know. But that's in Western medicine. If the kidneys are having a problem, they're not working well, a little bit of calcium stimulates the thing that stimulates the kidneys. And I know I'm simplifying, and probably the TCM and acupuncturists in the audience are grabbing their hair and going, "Ah!" But, you know, if I got it wrong, send me a letter. Okay,
great.
I hope that helps. And at least it's, you know, a little ray of hope for you, okay?
Yes, yes. Awesome. I appreciate all your time.
Well, thank you for calling from, and where did you call from?
Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm so glad you listened down there in Los Angeles. And, of course, you would immediately know what I meant about the Ventura Freeway.
Okay.
Yeah,
I did.
405 is the San Diego, you know.
That's right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, you have a great evening and hopefully a great month.
Thank you, too, and I'll be in touch.
All right, great. Bye-bye for now. Okay, we're going to go back to the second half of Jacqueline's question. So Jacqueline was the one who asked about the arsenic in babies, and she wanted to know our safety advice for traveling during the holidays via airplane and rental car between states, California and Louisiana. Well, Jacqueline, I don't know if you've been listening to the show, but presumably you will. I'm not really thrilled with the idea of you traveling. For all the reasons that I talked about, we're in the middle of a major flare. If you do travel, be aware that you're going to need to get a test before most airlines will let you on the plane. It's been usually reliably 3 days is kind of the thing. When you get where you're going, you're going to have to quarantine. And that does not mean staying in mom's house and having breakfast, lunch, and dinner with mom. It means actually quarantining. Yeah, not really quarantining, but isolating. You're going to have to isolate for that whole 14 days. Mask on the airplane. Don't eat on the airplane. So I presume that you probably don't have a direct flight, so you're going to eat when you're off the airplane and try to bring a portable fan with batteries. I have one that hangs around my neck. If I had to air travel or I was in a dodgy place, I turn it on and I have the air blowing away from me while I take my bites of my food. Bring something that you can eat quickly, and juice or milk with a straw, wearing the mask over your nose and just kind of slipping the straw in through the side would be the best way to kind of get refuel on what promises to be a long flight. Obviously, wash your hands. Go and buy an N95 mask. Wear it when you go to the bathroom in the airplane. Now, I wear an N95 when I go to a public bathroom because when you flush the toilet, you aerosolize COVID, which is in your poo. So there, we talked last week about tracing index cases of COVID. Well, yeah, you can. But that also means it's in your poo, and it means it's in the air in public restrooms. So N95 in the bathroom, and get in there and get out of there. And don't use the blowers, because some of the virus will, in fact, get into the blower because it'll settle on the vent. And we really don't know if the blowers are actually stirring it up again. So I just wipe my hands on my pants or carry a handkerchief. You're going to want to, when you get into the airplane, you're going to, first of all, sanitize everything. You're going to sit down, buckle your seatbelt, and then get out your sanitizer, and you're going to hit the tray table, both sides of it, the little slit for the tray table that turns it up and down. Then you're going to go over the seatbelt, which you're probably going to open up once or twice on the airplane and forget to sanitize your hands. So get that seatbelt buckle clean. I tend to wear gloves so that I can use lots of sanitizer and not give myself dermatitis. But if you want to take your gloves off, you can after you've gotten yourself all settled down. And remember, if you put stuff in the overhead, you're going to need to clean off that handle. So because you're going to be reaching back up for it, and you might want to put on a second pair of gloves. You want to sanitize the armrests. You can't really sanitize the seat, but it's the hard plastic surfaces that are going to have the virus for the longest dwell time. I use colloidal silver in my nose. You might be able to use iodine. The 0.5% iodine is a good thing to spray in your nose. It probably kills the virus. We do not have data. It's just logical because it kills just about everything, just like the silver. I don't have solid data, even in ferrets, but it won't. I do have data that it won't hurt you, and it might just help. I like using saltwater spray in my nose when I'm flying. That keeps my mucus nice and thin and runny, and that helps protect me from getting the virus on the thing. So Sandra wants to know if getting the flu shot now would make her more vulnerable by reducing immunity. No, Sandra, I think it's quite the opposite. The flu vaccine does not cause a substantial immune issue. I would urge you to get the flu shot and go back home and continue to shelter and keep yourself safe. But as I've said, you can go to your doctor for a drive-through, and there are other places that will do that. You must consider just getting the regular flu shot if they don't have the quadrivalent, if they don't have the one that has extra antigen. Just get the regular flu shot right now, because the extra antigen one is in short supply. And at 65, you're probably going to be able to react well to the flu shot. But this is not a good time, as I said, to be in that group that gets both of them. And none of us can guarantee that we won't be exposed. And none of us can guarantee that we won't get sick. Not completely. So let me see. We've got just a couple of minutes. I have a wonderful story that I've been saving for just this kind of moment where I have to fill a couple of minutes. And that is an octopus-inspired sucker used to transfer thin, delicate tissue grafts and biosensors. So the problem with tissue grafts, we can grow them, and on a plate of nutrient material, and we have a whole bunch of flexible electronics that we can put on wounds, regenerative medicine, biosensing. The problem is these things are so friggin' delicate that when we try to pick them up and move them, they tear. We're talking about something that's about like a single ply piece of toilet paper that is wet. It's very hard to get these wonderful, miraculous tissue sheets where they need to be without their wrinkling. They're used, for example, in cornea tissue transplant surgery. But it's really difficult to get them over there. So a group at Purdue University, considering the problem, probably went to the aquarium and got inspired. So they invented, essentially, a fake octopus sucker that was drastically going to speed up the amount of time that it's going to take. So currently what they do is they grow them on a temperature-sensitive soft polymer, then they take it off of moisture and it shrinks, and then finally the thing releases. But so they thought, well, octopuses pick up both wet and dry objects with small pressure changes in their suction cups. So why don't we come up with a suction cup rather than a chemical adhesive? So they designed a manipulator made of a temperature-responsive layer of soft hydrogel attached to an electric heater. To pick up the sheet, the researchers heat the hydrogel to shrink it, and then they press it to the sheet, turn off the heat, the hydrogel expands, creates suction, and off we are to the racers with that flexible soft tissue attached to the sucker. They put it where it needs to be, beautiful and unwrinkled, turn the heater back on. The hydrogel shrinks, releases the sheet, takes about 10 seconds. So I am loving this. It might be possible to actually put pressure sensitors in here. You'd think about robots, surgery. You think about how about these kinds of manipulators, and how about we have that kind of precision in surgery? Well, stay tuned. When it happens, you'll hear it right here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Thanks so much for listening. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.